Welcome to the Two Cities Podcast, a podcast about theology, culture, and discipleship. And this is episode 199. In this episode, we're talking about gender as love with Dr. Felipe DeVale. Dr. Felipe DeVale is department chair and assistant professor of biblical and systematic theology at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School in Deerfield, Illinois. And he's the author of the book that we're excited to discuss in this episode, Gender as Love, a theological account of human identity, embodied desire, and our social worlds, published by Baker. Team members on the episode from the two cities include Dr. Madison Pierce and me, Dr. John Anthony Dunn. So, Madison, I really enjoyed this conversation with Dr. DeVale and thought that he had a lot of really helpful insights, a lot of really great clarifications on a lot of buzzy terminologies that we might be familiar with, but, you know, might not be entirely sure how it relates to other things. So I thought there was just a lot of clarity here. And, you know, he's charting a new way forward, a new way of thinking about gender, which is pretty unique and innovative and quite interesting. What were some of the takeaways that you had from our conversation with Dr. DeVale?
Yeah, I really appreciated the summaries that he was giving us of the book. And I feel like this book is, even beyond the conversation, it just offers a lot of nuance and useful thinking. And I think it's really clear in this conversation how much sort of bonus material there is. It's like, you come wanting a definition of gender, and you get to learn about Augustinian views of love, and you get to even learn about Webster's view of what it means to be a theologian and things like that. And so there's just a lot of richness there, and I think that really informed our conversation.
And if you haven't already, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a review. You can also follow us on Facebook, X, Instagram, or visit us at our website at thetwocities.com. And with that, here's our conversation with Dr. Felipe DeVale. Well, Dr. DeVale, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my goodness. Thanks for having me on.
So we're really excited to talk about your new book, Gender as Love. As a way to begin, could you tell us a little bit about what you're sketching out? What is this paradigm, gender as love? What's the thesis of your book?
Yeah, I'll try to do it in a brief sort of way. The kind of conviction that I'm trying to put forward is that, so gender is this thing that I think sort of belongs in the neighborhood of human identity, right? We have all kinds of identities, and our gender identity is one of them. And we need to sort out how to think about identity in a sort of recognizably theological way. And so the argument I put forward, and it takes a lot more time than this, is if our identities are a matter of the objects of our love, then our gender identities is a matter of the objects of our gendered loves. And so I try to take time to talk about how love works and how it's not just some intuitive thing. You know, there's got to be this robust understanding of love that we work with. Talk about what a gendered good is or a gendered object of love and how we sort that out in conversation with, you know, contemporary theory and stuff like that. But the main idea is if our identities are about our loves, then our gender identities are about our gendered loves.
Thanks, Felipe. That's super helpful. And as you've indicated here, you interact a lot with contemporary literature on gender. Could you situate yourself just a little bit and maybe even begin to unpack some of the things in the first couple of chapters?
Yeah, that's great. I start out, so it's really hard to figure out how to talk about gender well. That's probably an obvious thing to observe, because it's not terribly clear what the object of our investigation actually is, nor is it clear what the best tools are for figuring out what this thing is that we call gender. Now, sometimes I'll go to conferences and I'll present a paper about gender. And then the first question is like, well, what if there isn't this thing called gender? And I'm like, oh, that's okay. So it's not even agreed upon that we have this thing called gender, much less what it ought to be if we're going to try to understand it well. And I start out the book by observing two sort of major bifurcations that I have witnessed in the literature, both the theological literature and in just the sort of secular feminist theory literature as well, that these two governing bifurcations operate pretty strongly. The big one is this division or this bifurcation between gender understood as an essence and gender understood as a social construct. You're nodding. This isn't video, but you're nodding. So you've heard this before. It's pretty commonplace to hear, that if gender is a social construct, then it can't be this thing that we call an essence. And it's to the point now where if you say somebody's view is essentialist, it usually means that it's got some bad attributes to it. But then if we stop to think about what is an essence and what is a social construct, it's not altogether clear what we mean by these operating categories. So there's this major division. If gender is an essence, it's not a social construct. If gender is a social construct, it's not an essence. Usually when folks talk about gender as an essence, they refer to it as as gender is identical to sex, where sex just refers to the biological properties that differentiate males from females, from intersex folks. Or they might mean that gender is identical to sex plus some kind of theory of action. My two favorite examples to give that are super counterintuitive, but they end up having the same exact gender theory are Steven Pinker, the Harvard evolutionary psychologist who tried to start his own university in Texas at one point, and James Dobson, right, the founder of Focus on the Family, right? Two very different individuals. Well, they turn out to have the same kind of view of gender, where it's reducible to those attributes that differentiate males from females, plus a theory of action. For Pinker, it's evolutionary psychology. So my sort of like hardwired impulses to propagate my genes are what characterize my social behavior as a man. And for women, it's their desire to have safe conditions for reproduction. That's his view. But then for James Dobson, it's testosterone and how testosterone funds male interest. He's got this book called Bringing Up Boys, where he says that testosterone funds male interest in like war and karate and all this other stuff and all the stuff that I'm not interested in. So I was like, oh, okay, this is so. But that's the sort of essentialist view in the popular imagination when people tend to think about it, and it tends to be gender understood, maybe even reducible to sex or sex plus a theory of action. Now, gender as a social construct was developed out at, or in response to that kind of view, where gender is seen as conceptually distinct from sex, not necessarily separate. Sometimes people confuse the claim that gender and sex are conceptually distinct as gender and sex are like separated. That's not the case at all. That might be the case, but not all. Not everybody who makes that distinction holds to that. But if you hold that gender is a social construct, you think that gender is is produced by the kinds of rules and associations and goods that are particular to cultures. And so the sort of slogan that you might hear, it was really popular in kind of like second wave feminism, was that gender is the social meaning of sex, right? Or something like that. And now this sort of debate between essentialists and social constructionists has been going on for like almost 100 years, and it tends to be pretty sort of intransigent. Like if one is one is not the other. And what I'm trying to say is why we need to hold to this strong division between these two things. And in point of fact, that we have a lot of resources within Christian theology and Christian history to say that when we start talking about things like our identities, we should keep in mind both of these sorts of like aspects about embodiment and these aspects about social identity, that these don't have to be necessarily antithetical things in our lives, but that should go together in a sort of harmonious way. Now, the devil's in the details. You got to figure out how those two things go together. But this first major bifurcation that I observe is between essentialists and social constructionists. The second one, a lot shorter, is more methodological. A lot of folks really like gender and like talking about gender, but really don't like talking about theology. And a lot of folks really like theology, they don't like talking about gender. So when I say like I'm a theologian who works on gender, a lot of people love the theologian part, but not the gender part. And a lot of people love the gender part, but not the theologian part. So this is other bifurcation that's more methodological in nature. I think we should give up on both of those bifurcations. Both of those should just be debunked. that we should be actively trying to bring together these social and embodied elements, and to do so in recognizably theological ways. And so I try to dig up theorists, both secular and theological, and theologians who try to do this well. And I try to build off their work and try to say there's a new conversation that's beginning to arise. And there's some new and interesting things about gender from this new conversation if we just give up on these really rigid bifurcations that have held us captive for so long. So that's chapters one and two in sort of a nutshell. But where I situate myself is, okay, can we bring these two things together? And can we develop a theological account of gender that seeks to resist this harsh separation?
So with the bifurcation of gender and theology, it seems like you are pointing towards a both and sort of approach.
Yeah.
Would you say that's the same thing with the social constructivism and the gender essentialism? Or would you say that you're going for more of a midway point between them?
I think so. I want to be careful about how I phrase this. I think both of these sorts of articulations have valuable insights, but they miss their common value because of the sort of methodological rigidity that they articulate their positions. If I give a concrete example, you will often hear in sort of social constructionist circles that the body doesn't have any sort of moral normativity that can be attached to it just by the fact that it's a body. And I think that's not a very good claim to make at all, right? If I know something's a human body, I know that there are certain kinds of things I just shouldn't do to it, right? I think both have insights, but because they sort of ramp up their views to a level, they're forced to a sort of reductive maneuver whereby the other position is kind of flattened out of all of its benefit. And that's what I want to try to avoid, is to say like, yeah, we both of these views actually have some really valuable things to say and bring our attention to really valuable aspects of what it means to be gendered in this world. But at the same time, like the way we've gone about it, and the sorts of like really rigid methodological assumptions, the sort of like pushing theology to the side or pushing any kind of theory to the side, that both of these things have actually made our conversation worse. So it's like a both and, but also neither, I don't know. But I hope that comes across clear enough.
Thanks, Felipe. That makes sense. You know, just for readers who are wanting to get a quick insight into this, you do have those four theses that appear at various points, and that does kind of help people to orient themselves to what you're arguing. And I found it really helpful as a reader as well.
I can read those theses if it would be helpful.
Wonderful.
I'm just looking for any reason I have, because I just got the book in the mail. This is like the second version of it to have existed in the world. But in the third chapter, when I'm trying to, I cover two different theorists who I think have looked at the sort of constructionist essentialist debate and have said, this isn't really the best way to go about it. And I try to distill four theses that they sort of suggest that I try to bring out in sort of theological dimensions, so that we can get an operative account of gender. So I try to do that, and I try to give like a one sentence definition of what I think gender is. That was like when I was sitting down and writing, I thought, you know, if I need to do something that the Supreme Court's not able to do, which is give a one sentence definition of gender, you know, so maybe this book will sell millions and millions of copies or something like that. No, that's not true. I don't hope for that at all, actually. But the four theses are these. It's one is gender is an essence, though this is not reducible to or identical with biological determinism or biological essentialism. So I try to disambiguate between various different kinds of gender essentialism. I try to say that we minimally need a sort of modest, non-necessarily biological form of essentialism to avoid a position that's been called gender skepticism, according to which there's gender terms don't have any stable meaning. If you've ever read somebody like Judith Butler, that's kind of her view, at least in my reading of Butler. Number two is that the complexity of gender, the noetic effects of sin, and the current conditions of oppression complicate our epistemic access to gender's essence. So there's a there's a sort of claim about metaphysics, and there's a claim about our epistemology, how well we can say or that we know what gender boils down to. I said that's actually really hard to do. All the same, we can be assured that issues surrounding gender will be rectified in the eschaton. Number three, any theory or theology of gender must be consistent with and supportive of the cultivation of justice. That's a positive articulation of an objection I give to the social constructionist view, is that it's really hard to make sort of cross-cultural moral evaluations of gender categories if gender is a sort of culturally bounded thing. And we see this through really concrete practices. I talk about the case of Pitcairn Island, but we can even see this in debates right now surrounding, so Alice Walker wrote a book about female genital mutilation in West Africa, criticizing it. So is that a colonialist thing? Is it not? Part of the difficulty in answering that question has to do with whether or not we think our moral judgments have to be bound by certain kinds of cultural considerations. So I want to say the positive version of that is that no, like if we're going to articulate gender theory, it has to be the kind of thing that's supportive of and cultivates justice. So not just avoiding moral sort of ambiguity, but also saying that there are certain kinds of things we need gender to be in order for it to reflect God's intent in the world. And then the last one is that gender is concerned with selves or identity and with the way selves organize social goods pertaining to their sex bodies or to the perceived sex bodies. I try to talk about that distinction if we want, but those are the four theses. I think if you want to like sort of get a good working theology of gender off the ground, that's I think minimally what you need on the table.
Thanks. Those are super helpful. And I think it is really useful the way that they sort of weave together those two ideas. It strikes me that so when we think about gender essentialism, you know, people might be more familiar with some of the reservations that you express. You know, they would say, oh, of course, you know, an issue with that view would be the presence of trans and intersex people. You know, they could even, you know, especially in the way that you line it out in the book, you know, if that's actually in a sense, a sort of socially constructed idea of what sex is, that's a problem. But there are lots of different objections that are sort of like plain. But I found, I mean, and this is because I'm not familiar with the literature, I found your objections to the social construct view really new and I think innovative, you know, pretend like they're innovative, even if they're not because of my ignorance.
Hey, we can pretend could that. You, yeah. I'm very innovative.
Could you say a little bit more? You've given us a taste, but I think both of them are really helpful.
Yeah. So the view that gender is a social construct is sort of canonical in most, like if you go into a theory classroom, for instance, that's going to be the view that's assumed. There are different types of social constructionist accounts, and there are different ways, like different intensities of social construction and different ways to understand it. But the claim that gender is a social construct seems to be fairly undisputed, even though there have been some fairly significant challenges raised against it. And so it's a terribly old view. I think it goes back to the 17th century with a guy called François Paulin de La Barre, right? So it's not new. It's not sort of invented recently. It's not sort of a mere response to contemporary political movements. No, it's a really serious attempt to understand the kinds of intuitions that we have about our gendered lives, right? That when we think about gender, we think about cultural goods like clothing, like it's Halloween in 3 days, and if you want to see an example of really obvious cultural goods that are gendered, go to a Halloween store and see that there are men's Halloween costumes and women's Halloween costumes, and they're all and they're sometimes very problematically distinct, right? And so we live in this sort of gendered world. We encounter it every time we step out our doors, and the social constructionist view is an effort to catch up some of these intuitions, some of these correct intuitions, I think, that when we think about gender, at least when we think about it descriptively, we're thinking about social goods. At the same time, if we want to say something more than just that gender is social, but that it's socially constructed, we're committing ourselves to a further set of claims, particularly that gender categories are bound by context. So every social constructionist account that I have read says that social constructs are context specific. And you can see this with other kinds of social constructs like money, right? Like if you go and try to spend a dollar in another country, an American dollar in another country, it's not going to go very well, right? You need to use the social construct in the context for which it was designed. And so if gender is context bound in that kind of way, we would have to be committed to the fact that there are as many genders as there are contexts, right? And there are contemporary theorists who will say that like contexts are actually not just country, like not just in terms of, you know, hop on a plane and we're in a different context, but even like, I mean, I lived in Texas for 4 years and now I live in the Midwest. Those are very different contexts, especially when it pertains to gender, right? So context specificity is sort of all around us. But it seems to me that if we want sort of gender theory and theology to do the work that we want it to do, if we want it to be aimed at justice and all these kinds of things, we have to be able to say that there's some kind of contextual continuity that occurs, that even though my grandfather, who lived in Brazil in the early 20th century and observed norms radically different than the ones that I observed with respect to masculinity, that even though that's the case, then I'm still the same kind of thing as him. Or if I say to my daughter something like, hey, I'm reading Sojourner Truth's story right now, and she's a really virtuous woman, I want you to grow up to be like her. Even though my daughter's growing up in a radically different context and culture than Sojourner Truth, there's still, I want to say, like, there's a kind of virtue that I want you to see that you can emulate. It doesn't seem to me to be counterintuitive, but if gender is bound by context, those kinds of claims aren't possible. And that's extended to moral claims too, that's where I start to get kind of especially nervous, is that there are cross-cultural injustices in the world, right? And there are things that seem normal to us because of where we grew up that are still highly morally problematic, right? And we can think about how it wasn't seen as problematic that women didn't vote until about 100 years ago. Right, like if you were an American living in the United States in the 1890s, right, it wouldn't have seemed problematic to you that, you know, the women you knew couldn't vote for the next president. But even though that's a contextually bound moral assumption, we can still say that was actually wrong, right? Like it was wrong that women couldn't vote, and I hope that's not a controversial thing to say, but, right? It was morally wrong. For that, so, but yeah. We need the kind of theoretical underpinning within our gender, our understandings of gender, to be able to sustain those kinds of claims. If gender is bound by those contexts, I think it becomes really, really hard to make claims like that are cross-culturally sort of adjudicating moral problems with respect to gender. So that's why I'm not a social constructionist at the end of the day, but I think that they capture some really valuable insights.
Thanks, Felipe. That's super helpful. We've said a lot about what your view is not. To nuance quite a bit. I mean, you've been able to make some positive claims as well. So what is gender, and why in the world are you talking about Augustine so much in this book?
Yeah, you wouldn't have expected that, huh? It's funny. I tried to keep the word Augustine off like the outside parts of the book as much as possible, because that's kind of like a deterring factor. I mean, I do not defend Augustine's view of gender. That should make this really, really clear. I think he had a problematic view of gender. I think it's problematic for reasons that people, I think, often miss. And I think so we can debate about what exactly was problematic about it. But I think in the end, I'm not trying to defend Augustine's view. I'm trying to defend his view of human love. So why? Why would I want to defend his view of human love? A view that I think is sort of conceptually separate from all the stuff that he has to say about gender. That fourth thesis I mentioned that says that gender has to do with identity or selves, right? If you open up the DSM-5, it's going to say that gender is an identity, right? Now, very often, I think theologians get really squeamy about identity language, because they think it has to do with sort of modernism or voluntarism, or we can just decide to be whatever we want or whatever. I don't think that's the case at all. I mean, there are problematic understandings of identity for sure, but we shouldn't throw the whole concept out altogether. I think that there's a clue there for how to think about gender well theologically, because it turns out Christian scripture, the Christian tradition, had a lot of really helpful things to say about the nature of human identity and the way we go about our lives and sort of weave together a coherent narrative of about ourselves and about the social goods that we sort of attach to ourselves and the relationships that we engage in. So I want to say that identity is actually really important, and that gender is one aspect of our identities. In fact, a really, really important one. Now, I have all kinds of other identities, right? I'm a professor, I'm a husband, I'm a father, I'm a Liverpool fan, right? I'm all kinds of, I wear all kinds of different hats. Now, but in order for me to be those things, if you want to say, well, what does it mean for you to be a professor or a Liverpool fan? I would have to start making recourse to the kinds of social goods that inform the relevant aspects of that identity. So if I want to say I'm a professor, I'm going to start talking about the classes I teach, the institution that I teach at, the kinds of research that I do, right? And these are all kinds of activities and goods that make up this identity of being a professor. If I say I'm a Liverpool fan, I'm going to talk about how I watch the games or have a jersey or whatever, right? Or have this irrational sense of sadness when they lose or something like that, right? So in order to make sense of our identities, we need to make recourse to social goods. So we need to talk about, okay, what does it mean? Which social goods are relevant for gender first? But then second, what is the right kind of way for us to relate to these social goods to begin with? And that's where I think love is where it's at. Because love in the Christian tradition has been the sort of central way we understand not just who we are, but also how we relate rightly to the world around us, right? So scripture, there's this frequent recourse to the nature of the heart, right? And that, like, if you want to know about somebody, you got to kind of find out about their heart and how the heart is this place from which love is sort of, from where love comes out. I'm trying to figure out a better way to say that. From where love comes from, right? It comes from your heart. And so, okay, so that's step number one. Okay, let's figure, okay, if we want to talk about identities and selves and social goods, we got to talk about love. And I think Augustine is actually a really good guide in helping us think about love. For Augustine, who we are is a matter of our loves. If he says, if you want to know a person's quality, you have to know their loves. You have to know where their loves are directed, how their loves are structured and ordered, and how they feel about the things that they love. They have to, you have to have this sort of reflective activity about your own loves, so that you're not just loving willy-nilly, but you're actually responsible in the ways that you love. And what's really crucial for me is that Augustine sees love as beginning and ending with God. Love begins with God because God is love, and the Holy Spirit is that person whose procession is a procession of love. We see like Romans 5:5. Augustine cites Romans 5:5 more than 200 times in his corpus. It's like favorite Bible verse, and it talks about how the Holy Spirit is poured out into our hearts by love, right? And so love begins with God, and God creates all things out of a motivation to love. And so creation is sort of infiltrated with patterns of love, and our hearts are sort of like the way that God wants us to live is to live by love. I mean, Romans 13:8, how love fulfills the law. Augustine does a lot of really fun stuff with that. He thinks all virtue is just an expression of love, right? So love is this sort of thing that's both created and social, right? And so it's this concept that bridges that initial bifurcation that I'm trying to resist. Whereas I think sort of gender conversations get stuck when they separate social and sort of natural elements. I want to say that here's this thing that the Christian tradition has given us, this concept of human love that says that's true of us if we live 1 second or if we live 100 years. We are lovers by nature. And it's the primary way by which we engage our social worlds. And so the things we love are how social goods get appropriated to us. Augustine uses language that they get glued to us. Or he says, imagine like a beach, you're walking on the beach and you see your footprints after having walked in a certain part of the beach. He says, the things we love leave their footprints on our souls, right? Which is this lovely image, and it's hard to unpack exactly what he means by that. But the things that we love, right? So my identity as a Liverpool supporter, the way I relate to the objects that are relevant for my identity as a Liverpool supporter is through my loves, right? It's through these common objects of love. And you can see this in real. I was at a pub one time when Liverpool was playing, and I'm not a physical guy, you know, just that's not relevant, but I'm minding my own business. I have a book and I'm watching Liverpool play, and they score, and this random stranger runs up to me and gives me a hug, which is like my worst nightmare. But it's because we share this common object of love and a common identity that we have this, that certain like kinds of cultural and relational identities are cultivated. And I think the same kind of thing happens with gender, is that as a people, we sort of agree on common objects of love to cultivate into gender identities. We sort of develop these sorts of social positions and social identities through these beloved cultural goods. That's just kind of how it happens. Now, there's this is the additional task as Christians that we have to order our loves, to make sure that our loves are responsible, because we love things the wrong way all the time. And that can be, we love the wrong things, or we love the right things in the wrong kinds of intensities, right? There's a way to love things that are good, but that doesn't respect their finitude, right? So we might expect a particular person to provide for us all of our joy and all of our fulfillment and all of our flourishing. And we pile this pressure on them, right? Through this sort of like far too intense love. And so this is where Augustine says that love, our primary love has to be for God, and all things have to be received as gifts from God, and according to the specifications of the gift giver. So that gives us a sort of moral angle to the objects of our love, that we have to love all of these things in God. And when we fail to do so is when we start getting really problematic understandings of how to relate to our social world. That's how we end up expecting too much from things or loving the wrong kinds of things. But we have this, so not only do we love gendered goods and how, and that brings those things to us as a kind of gendered identity, but we have this responsibility also to say, am I loving these things rightly? Is my gender identity the kind of thing that I'm cultivating in a responsible way that's conducive to my flourishing in Christ Jesus? And so it's a sort of, I interact a lot with Sarah Coakley, who's one of my favorite theologians. She talks about the ordering of desire, and I kind of have the same kind of notion where we say that it's not that we're gendered that's the problem, it's the way we're gendered. And that kind of goes for all of our social identities too.
So I love that you're bringing in Augustine here. And as you started to talk about this, you know, you framed it as Augustine is wrong on gender. And that kind of posture reminds me of the German critical posture of Sokratik, right? Where if you understand Paul's gospel and you see something that, you know, talks about slavery, for example, like in the household books, let's say, you can say, well, Paul is just not in line with the gospel. And so you can use Paul to critique Paul. Would you say that you're doing a critical approach that Augustine is not, you know, living out his own sort of like theology of love when he talks about gender?
Yes. Sometimes the reason I say yes so confidently is because I don't think Augustine is internally consistent with himself, and I don't think he would claim to be actually ever. He's this sort of like scattershot theologian who writes in response to all kinds of different controversies, and then he'll say something early on in his career, and then like, you know, some Pelagians might come around and they'll say, hey, like what you said this, and it actually agrees with us, and he's like, well, I never said that, and you're like, no, you actually did, but you can change your mind, it's okay to change your mind, right? So I don't think he's a sort of underdetermined theologian. Right. He doesn't always agree with himself, and he'll say some things really forcefully in directions that are really good. And then he'll say some other stuff where you're like, what the heck were you thinking? You know, it's funny because I actually have some reservations about Sokratik in the Bible, because, you know, But like, because I think Augustine is this sort of admittedly internally inconsistent guy who's trying to just figure out how best to serve his churches, and some of the best theology he does in the pulpit, you know, and he's just trying to, and then one time he's writing about the Trinity and somebody steals the book and publishes it without his permission, which is like, can you imagine that, right? That's how we ended up with De Trin, right? And then he like had to finish the book really quickly because he was like, hey, who the heck steals somebody's book, right? So he's got this sort of like scattershot kind of ramshackle approach that isn't sort of neatly packaged at any point. And that allows for a kind of creative reading that is still faithful to him, I think. And we're not just kind of like doing whatever we want with his words, but like he is by his own admission kind of working things around in ways that doesn't always click together. So he's not kind of terribly systematic guy, but I think that there, so what I try to draw are these really interesting nuggets that that I think are really helpful for what we need to do in this life today, right? Sort of retrieval project. But there's a lot of debates about this for like really hardcore Augustinians, whether he like changed his mind or whether he's consistent all the way through. I have no horse in that race as long as people let me read Augustine the way I want to read him. So it's, you know, we could take it up with Carol Harrison if you want. Like,
I'm glad that you finally admitted that Augustine's not the Bible. I've been waiting for that for a few years now. But
I mean, I like him about as much as you can like him without, like, you know, sort of saying he's inerrant or something like that. Like, I
super humble. I think I have a series of questions that could be perceived as antagonistic, but they're not intended to be antagonistic. They're intended to be clarifying for your readers, because I actually like you a lot. Yeah. So, but just in case readers or hearers don't know that, I don't know why I'm talking about readers. So you talked a lot about the appropriation of gendered goods. So sort of stupid or antagonistic question, you know, the basic question is, what is a gendered good? But like, totally, do you mean lipstick, action figures? Like, what are you talking about here?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to be specific because we would be here all day, right? This is a sort of sociological question that we would have to sort of unpack. Now, the way I lay it out in the book is that I think there are at least two kinds of gendered goods. There are intrinsically gendered goods and extrinsically gendered goods. Intrinsically gendered goods are those gendered goods that have a sort of gender component as part of their definition. So you might think of a wet nurse or something like that. Being a wet nurse is a gendered good that if you took out the gendered element of it, you wouldn't have a wet nurse anymore. You'd have something else. Now, I think that there aren't very many of those, that there aren't very many gendered goods. I don't want to say that there aren't any, but I think that for the most part, what we have, what we deal with, and what we encounter in our lives are extrinsically gendered goods. These are goods that aren't gendered by definition, but acquire a gender meaning through the use that we make of them in our sort of contemporary lives and cultural activity. There are all kinds of examples that you can think about. Like, there are ones that are sort of like really obviously gendered. The work I'm trying to do right now has to do with the sort of like history of clothing and how we have different understandings of clothing, right? So like pants, you know, that's a really, right? Right now we think that that's not really a gendered good, right? Like women wear pants.
Trousers.
Right?
For our British listeners, he is referring to underwear.
Yeah, trousers, yeah. Although
I hate the word trousers. I hate the word trousers. I will never say that word. I just say jeans and slacks. I hate the word trousers. I don't know why, but I do.
You know, yeah, I mean, yes, trousers. So trousers, right? We don't, but there was a time where that wasn't gendered good, but that wasn't intrinsically the case. That was something that we had to sort of decide, but not decide, because it's not a sort of cognitive thing, but it's something that happened through our cultural practices. I mean, we can talk about nail polish too, for instance. Like, you know, when I was growing up, nail polish was something that women wore, right? And today, it's becoming more and more the case that it's not, right? And that tends to even occur apart from trans considerations. It's just people saying that that's not something that we're going to make rigidly gendered in one way or another.
even in metal, like subculture, like in, you know, metal and punk rock, like that, it was a thing.
Totally.
Yeah. I never did it personally, even though I was part of that. I'd go to shows. a lot of guys would have black nail polish, for example.
Yeah. Yeah. Eyeliner, right. In sort of like emo punk. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So these are these extrinsically gendered goods. Now, I think that when we want to say something good about gender theologically, we have at least two tasks. We need a descriptive task and we need a normative task. The descriptive task is, what is gender as we encounter it? What is the gendered world like as we go about our days and live our lives? What are these gendered goods that we already live with, right? Things like clothing, things like Halloween costumes or whatever, right? All of these various gendered goods that we encounter in our day-to-day lives, what are they? And then we can ask the question, is it right that these are the gendered goods that we have? Is it just? Is it the kind of thing that we want to see continue? Or is it the kind of thing that we want to resist, right? And that's the normative task. You know, my beef, I think, with how gender has been talked about, at least in theological circles, particularly in evangelical theological circles, is that we've done the normative task without having ever done the descriptive task, right? The sort of like worst example of this is the complementarian egalitarian debate in my mind, a debate that was invented in the 70s, right? It's this attempt to say what gender should be without ever taking stock of what gender actually is now. If I take the conclusions written by any of these authors and I try to say, like, okay, how should I go to the mall and buy clothes? Well, people don't go to the mall anymore. How should I go on Amazon and buy clothes, right? I'm not given any sort of concrete guidance, right? So we end up with gender theologies that are impracticable. And so the descriptive task is this task of having to look out into our world and ask the people who really know this stuff, like the sociologists, like the ethnographers, right? Like the anthropologists, and to say, what are these gendered goods that we encounter? Right. I just finished reading this book called Cinderella Ate My Daughter. It's a really fantastic book, especially if you've just watched the Barbie movie. It's a really good book to read right after the Barbie movie, because it talks about how, like, marketing, and particularly Peggy Ornstein's the author, she talks about how, like, Disney was this sort of like massive force in gendering markets, right? Because you can make a lot of money if you make the thing you're selling gender specific, right? So, you know, that's how the sort of like Princess Project in the sort of like 25 years ago began with Disney, right? They said, well, if we make the things that we're selling specific to little girls, and we say that buying these things will help the parents of these little children feel safer, then it turns out we're going to make a lot more money. And they did. And it was like exponentially more money, right? Because they were saying, okay, well, let's gender these goods, right? Disney, if you look at the stuff that Disney was making like in the 80s and the 70s, right? Snow White didn't wear pink, right? That's the thing. But now it's totally different. I think we have to start asking questions about like marketing and about sociology and things like that. So that's when we start asking questions about extrinsically gendered goods, it's going to be those, right? Like, why is it that when I go to Target and I want to buy a present for my neighbor's birthday party, 5-year-old birthday party, right? Why is it that when I go to the girls' aisle, I see certain kinds of things, and when I go to the boys' aisle, I see certain kinds of things? These are gendered goods. And then we have to ask the question, well, is that right? Like, should we live this way? Is this how God intended us for us to live? And very often the answer is no, because it's like most of these things are sort of driven by greed. But it's, you know, we need to do both, right? We need to do the sort of hard work of describing our world. And we need to do the hard work of saying, what's the difference between the world as it is and the world as it should be? So that's the gendered goods bit.
You know, this reminds me, I once heard Ben Shapiro say that he doesn't think hockey players, referring to men, can be manly because no one, you know, skating around on ice skates can be all that manly. And I just think, of course, in his mind, he's thinking you put on ice skates to figure skate, presumably to make a comment like that. Right. But I just think, couldn't you invert it and think, wow, these dudes have blades on their feet. You know what I mean? And make like a very math, like, you know, so but to me, it just seems like, isn't this all just like super arbitrary? Like that example is like, you know, the angle that he's looking at it versus the angle that, like, I mean, I don't even think about, you know, whether the skates are feminine, for example, because they're beating each other up. It's literally the only major professional sport where you're allowed to fight. You know what I mean? Like, it's a very manly, if you want to think of it in those terms, right? Obviously, there's women's hockey too, right? But like, you could imagine a very like alpha male person being really into hockey because of its like violence, right? But yet he rejects it because he views ice skates as inherently feminine.
Yeah, that's odd. What an odd thing to say. I mean,
well, I agree.
It's interesting because in claims like that, you see labels like masculine or feminine turned either into virtues or vices. Mm. Right? Like, you know, if you say, oh, that's manly, you're saying something positive. Like that's an accolade, right? Or if you say, you know, I mean, when I was growing up, if you get called like, oh, you're a girly girl or something like that, right? That was seen as a derogatory thing. That's horribly sexist, right? I think the sort of, when I say that I think we need to do normative work with gender, then we need to talk seriously about ethics and normativity. What I don't mean is what Ben Shapiro means, is like to take these gendered terms and sort of like identify one with vice and one with virtue. We've tried that and we ended up in really nasty places. What I mean is that like you're going to go out and you're going to be a gendered being. The world doesn't give you that option. The option you have is the way that you're going to do that as a disciple of Jesus virtuously, right? So it's not like, oh, hockey players can't be manly. It's more like, what are the virtues relevant to being a good human being as you are a hockey player, right? Because or should we even say that hockey is a gendered good, right? I mean, so we kind of presume in that whole description, we presume that hockey players are dudes, right? Well, that doesn't need to be the case at all. That shouldn't be the case at all, right? We could talk about, you know, football or whatever too, or the disproportionate ways that we pay attention to men's sports versus women's sports, right? Mm-hmm. And we're still like so far behind in that, and if we consider it globally, it's even worse, right? We can talk about how these are sort of disproportionately gendered goods, and this is not how things should be, right? They are that way, but that's not how they should be. I don't want to say that, like, you know, we need to put manliness on a sort of virtue scale. I want to say like, no, this is part of our discipleship all the way down. So yeah, that's it. I got a little nervous and you're like, Ben Shapiro said, I was like, oh no, what's he going to do?
Only negative anecdotes at that point are coming.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, that's super helpful. And that I think that's one of the other points that you raise with the gender construct social construct idea is that, you know, there are things that women experience disproportionately, you know, that go even beyond what we've described. And to eliminate categories is to eliminate the ability to talk about these injustices, which, yeah, I think is really important.
Yeah, the 1994 Violence Against Women Act is, I think, a really clear example of this, is that until then, it was not a legal guarantee that survivors of rape could sue their abusers, you know, even though it was always a legal guarantee that we shouldn't be violent, you know, that we shouldn't have violence done to us. It was a disproportionately attributed way that women were still the disproportionate recipients of greater violence. So we needed this additional law to say that, like, no, you have this right to. I think you're exactly right about that.
Okay, so I have another antagonistic question.
Yeah.
So I maybe I'm framing it that way and it's unnecessary, but
that's good.
So
that's good.
yeah, so obviously you know, if gender is love and if gender is about our objects of love, then does that overly romanticize love? And can men and women be friends?
Oh, good. No, love is not necessarily romantic. In fact, I think love can also be one of the ugliest things we can do to somebody. I think hatred is a form of love, for instance, because love is this, it derives from the things that we care about. Now, don't think positive care, the things that are important to us. Now, there are ways that things can be important to us that are actually really problematic, right? Like, the kinds of attention that we give to people and things like that, that can actually, I can be more specific if you want, but so no, I don't think that love necessarily has to be romantic. In fact, I think we see examples in scripture. I'm trying to pull one up right now. I think it's 1 Samuel 13, but it's, you know, I'm a systematic theologian. So no, 2 Samuel, I put 3 Samuel 13, that's not right. 2 Samuel 13, Amnon and Tamar, right? Where it says that Amnon loved Tamar and then at the end hated Tamar. And you ask the question, what happened in that chapter, right? Now, obviously, he physically assaulted her. He raped her, right? But did he go from loving her in this positive association, in this romantic association, to this hatred that had this negative association? No. Like, his love was always a species of his hatred, right? Like, the way that his loves were ordered within him, in specifically in relation to Tamar, were always going to be the kind of thing that affects destruction and domination and hatred, right? And so it's this sort of like wickedness that lived in the heart of, and that's, I would argue, this is sort of effective original sin that said that turns this thing that ought to be directed to God and to the benefit of our neighbor and our enemy that we call love, and twists and warps it and makes it something very, very ugly. Augustine sometimes calls it the libido dominandi, or the lust for domination, right? And he says that's what happens when sin gets a hold of our loves and makes us do all of these wicked things. We become, we instead of receiving the world as a gift from God that we ought to have delight in, we turn things into objects for consumption and for domination and for destruction. And he says that there's that's what twists our relationships and is the source of all kinds of human societal decay, right? And this is nowhere clearer than when he says that in the first chapter of the City of God, he talks about survivors of sexual assault in Rome after the sacking of Rome, who fled to his church in North Africa. Right. And he says that the people who did this to you, they were driven by a lust for domination that God stands against. That God emphatically says that this is not the way things are supposed to be. And so, you know, when I say love, I don't want to say that it's this romantic thing that, you know, it's, you know, or even like an eroticized thing. It's actually just this, we can't help but love. Right. You know, the things that we care about are objects of our love. It's how our wills work, but what happens when we don't operate out of the sort of fruits of the spirit is that our loves become sick and twisted, and drive us to do all kinds of evil. And so, yes, men and women can be friends, you know. And I think right, yeah. Madison and I have been friends for a long time. I hope it's all been a lie. No, men and women can be friends. They should be friends. Can you imagine if they weren't friends? It would make our world such a cold and hard place to be. But
Okay, so a follow question, and really this can be our last question, because although we could continue for so long, we probably need to wrap up soon. So said a lot about love. I'm glad to hear that we can still be friends. That was my deepest worry. But how does that relate to our conceptions of gender?
How does love relate to our conceptions of gender?
Yeah, just or that like pithy version. Yeah, how does having these gendered objects, having the appropriation of gendered goods, you know, how do those things relate to our conception of gender, especially?
There are certain things that we love in virtue of the fact that we are sexed beings, right? There are things that I love in virtue of the fact that I'm a professor. There are things that I love in virtue of the fact that I'm a father. In the same way, there are things that we love in virtue of the fact that we are sexed beings. And our loving those things is what generates this kind of, our loving them is what I say socially mediates them. It creates in them not just, it adds a layer of sort of social meaning to them that's relevant to our lives, right? So there are classes and there are students, but those classes and students are my classes and students because I have approached them in a posture of love that appropriates them to my life and story. In the same way, there are goods that we love in virtue of the fact that we are sex beings. Now we can talk about the relationship between sex and gender if we want. You said this is going to be the last question, so I'm just going to drop that one there. But I don't think that I think there's a conceptual distinction, but I don't think that they're like there's a gulf between them or that they swing free from one another. All the same, there are certain goods that we love in virtue of the fact that they're sex beings, and loving them is what gives to them a gendered meaning and our appropriation of them to us. So one of the things I really worry about is that sometimes when I read gender theory or when I read theologians that are interested in gender, is that gender is this abstract thing out there, and we talk about it in these kinds of like cold and calculated ways. Or in point of fact, like gender is this thing that's really, really important to individuals in their lives. And so whatever mechanism that we have to offer that makes gender one's own has got to be accountable to that level of importance that people really, really care about their gender identity. And so whatever mechanism we offer to explain that has to take into account the way that people care about their gender identity. And that's what I'm trying to get after with love. Through loving these things, they become objects of our care. They are woven into our stories. They develop into something like an organizational gender identity for us. And what that means, I think, is that I really want to make sure that this is clear, that there's a really beneficial pastoral benefit to this. Because I think sometimes people want to talk about gendered desires and gendered loves all the way over here, and all of our other desires are separate. They're operated or removed. People have gender identities, and all those other identities are separated from our gender identity. I think this is a fundamental mistake, that our identities, our loves, are all bound up together in this kind of bubble, right? And so my desires for things like safety, for things like comfort, for things like belonging, for things like purpose, for things like community, that all of those things are relevant to gender, right? And so if you spend any time listening to folks for whom gender is an object of pain or an object of difficulty, they're going to start talking about how they didn't feel safe this one time, or how they didn't feel like they had purpose when they were living in this kind of way. Or they feel ostracized or isolated, or conversely, they felt like they really belonged and felt like they were cared for. So pastorally, and these are all aspects of our loves, the things we fear, the things we care about, the things we feel safe with, these are all sort of downstream of our objects of love. So pastorally, asking about loves requires knowing somebody at the level of their fears and their desires and what makes them comfortable, makes them feel like they belong. And it may seem like those things are not relevant to gender, but they absolutely are. They absolutely are, because it's all bound up together. We can't isolate gender from the rest of us, as though human desires and identities were easily isolatable. Isolable? What's the word I'm looking for there? Anyway, one of those two, right? Gender is mixed up with all of these other desires. And so if you want to be good ministers, we have to see the way it's situated within all of those other cares and all of those other aspects of our identity. So I think it yields this additional benefit. Like, not only is it a way to talk about gender that enables us to think about how people really care about their gender identity, but it allows us to situate it within all of those other aspects of who we are, and how we live our lives, and when we feel safe, when we feel comforted, when we don't. And I think it does that descriptive element. It does a better job with that, at least in my opinion.
Well, Dr. DeVale, thanks so much for joining us. I should say I misspoke, actually. It wasn't Ben Shapiro who made that comment about hockey being unmanly. It was actually Matt Walsh. This is someone I conflate with Ben Shapiro all the time. they're basically the same person in my mind. But anyways, because Madison had said this would be the last question, I won't ask you what is a woman now, but thank you so much for your time, for joining us, and for this great work. We hope everybody checks out your new book, Gender as Love, published by Baker.
Yo, thank you so much. It was a delight to be with you guys.